You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, that are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works Volume by Dr. Steiner, number 181. Main title is Dying Earth and Living Cosmos. It's composed of three cycles of lectures. I am on the fifth lecture of the last cycle called The Need for New Forms of Consciousness, numbered lecture 19, given in Berlin on the 23rd of July, 1918, translated by Matthew Barton. Let us explore this question. Why do people not realize that the content, the spiritual and cultural contents of the different epochs they pass through in different lives on earth are markedly different? Why do so many people believe that humankind has altered very little in millennia since historical records began? Whereas, in fact, spiritual science teaches us that souls have indeed changed essentially during the third, fourth, and fifth post-Atlantean cultural epochs. We ourselves are now living in the fifth epoch. The knowledge we gain through the science of the spirit shows us that the human soul has definitely changed. But if we consider historical records as historians usually interpret them, they seem to give little indication of such changes. To approach this question, I recently tried to show that in fact these changes do become apparent if we examine the soul aspect of humanity's history. I tried to explain how differently human souls experienced things in, say, the 11th and 12th centuries compared with today. As an illustration, I tried to shed some light on the quality of soul of someone like Bernard of Clairvaux in the 12th century. One could do the same in relation to other souls. But before we pursue this further, let us first return again to the core of this question and ask the following. What prevents a person from properly perceiving the changes he undergoes through succeeding earthly lives? He is prevented, first and foremost, by the fact that in our present stage of earthly evolution, he has very little perception of the true nature of his capital I, his real human essence. People would conceive of their own nature and being in very different ways if certain hindrances did not obstruct their view. Later we will speak further of these obstacles, but for now, as a kind of hypothesis, let us consider how a person would see himself in the world if he could perceive his true nature and being. If people could do this, they would observe a great change occurring in their personal life between birth and death. However old a person might be, whether 20, 30, or 50, he would be able to look back to his earlier life, back toward birth, and see himself in ongoing metamorphosis. He would grasp more clearly the changes he has undergone, and also form hopeful conceptions of the future with an eye to further such changes. In past lectures, I have spoken of these hopeful, forward-looking thoughts of the future. The way we are today, we do not think very much about how we have changed over time, because by and large, we do not consider our soul nature sufficiently. However strange this may sound, people today always split themselves into two parts when they think of themselves. On the one hand, they see their physical body, regarding it as something fairly constant and fixed during their whole life. They know that they have grown, of course, that they were once small and then grew taller, but that is more or less all they are aware of in relation to their outward physical nature. Take a simple fact. You cut your nails. Why? because they grow. This is an example of how the outward corporeality of your organism is continually divested. You actually repulse your organism's physicality, pushing it outward so that after a certain time, no more than 6 to 7 years, what existed in you as matter and substance 7 or 8 years before is no longer present in you. You continually repulse or extrude your materiality, but are unaware of this. Do not perceive that you are melting outward and reconstituting yourself from within. Think how differently we would regard ourselves if we knew that we are, in a sense, repulsing our physical body continually, divesting ourselves of it, and inwardly reconfiguring ourselves. If we observed this ongoing metamorphosis at work in us. But this would connect with something else. If we really were fully aware that this body of ours is something we possess for no more than 7 years, after which its former substance has been discarded, we would regard ourselves as far more spiritual than we usually do. We would no longer have the illusory idea that we were first small and then just grew bigger, but would know, rather, that the stuff we were made of as a young child has gone, and what remains or persists in us is actually not material at all, but something transmaterial. If we took full cognizance of this, we could look back on our life, back to childhood, and see what it is of us that has remained constant. Then we would recall ourselves in spiritual terms. We could absorb far more spiritual ideas about ourselves if we were aware of what actually occurs. And something further would be associated with this. We would see ourselves in far less abstract terms. In a sense, we transform ourselves into a spiritual point, speaking of this as our capital I. We think that our I was present in our childhood and continued to be present in us, is still there now, and so forth. But this I of ours is something we picture only as a kind of spiritual point. If we could entertain the idea that actually we are always melting away on the outside and reconstituting ourselves within, we would not be able to help comprehending this I of ours as the active, dynamic principle that instigates this divesting and reconstituting process. We would regard ourselves as something much more real and inwardly active. In brief, when considering our I, we would not be contemplating our abstract I as we do now, but could survey how this I works upon our body in inner activity, leading it from one metamorphosis to another. Thus we would correct various, really very mistaken ideas to which we are prone because of what I have described here. To say that we grow bigger during childhood is not correct, for the truth is more complex. In infancy, our physical and corporeal activity is experienced more as being one with our soul spiritual activity. And because of this, our head organism is in closer proximity to our reproductive and sexual organism. Later, these two experiences diverge and are differentiated, so that head experiences and bodily experiences become more detached from each other. The material organism that we were as children does not grow bigger since it is divested, melts away, if you like. But if we differentiate ourselves so that the two poles of our being grow more distant from each other, in consequence, substance is integrated into a configured body in which the two poles have drawn apart. And it seems to us as if we had just grown. But we do not simply grow. We become inwardly differentiated, and thereby connect at a later age with different outward things than in infancy. Later on, our head organization inevitably stands at a further remove from direct earth forces than before. Our head elevates itself, and the fact that we grow is connected with this. All these ideas change if we absorb and integrate the truth about such things, but we do not do so. We misconceive the continually metamorphosing and changing body and picture it growing out of itself, growing bigger, and therefore we fail to see what a rich, inward, mobile, and living thing our I actually is, continually working upon us from birth to death. If we could picture ourselves in this way, our ideas about this self would become unified. But modern human beings have not been able to conceive of themselves like this for a long time. And this is connected with human destiny and the whole evolution of our age. Rather than closely encountering his living, active I, which in fact constitutes the organism from year to year, a person splits it. He regards his organism as something very consistent on the one hand, and on the other has an abstract and insubstantial view of his I. And then he sees himself as a sensory organism on the one hand, a corporeal organism, in consequence of which he cannot really come close to reality, because things only make, in quotes, impressions on him, rather than revealing their true nature. He cannot get near to the, quote, thing in itself, close quote, instead only perceiving phenomena. It is true that if we regard our flesh and blood as something fixed and consistent, this conclusion has a certain justification. Then, on the other hand, he considers his insubstantial I and discovers, say, a sense of duty living in it. He reflects upon all that can be summarized as categorical imperative in us, but in doing so, splits into two what is encompassed in a whole. People thus become Kantians, splitting the unity of human nature into two separate parts, and this profoundly informs their way of thinking. People today are not well fitted to comprehending the full scope of their nature in the world. They split themselves, as I have described. But this in turn means that we never have the real nature of our soul before our I, EYE, of spirit, since the soul element is continually working upon and changing our body. Rather than a view of the soul, we perceive our abstract body divided from our abstract capital I, without regard for our whole unified human nature. This perception of our whole unified being would, however, lead us to see that this unified being changes greatly from incarnation to incarnation. The true, authentic human I, which conceals itself from our soul perception in the present moment, is what changes from one life to another. Of course, if you consider only the abstract I rather than the tangible, active human I, you cannot discover that this I becomes so different from one life to the next. After all, in the abstract, everything of some affinity is seen as identical. Naturally, a soul retains similarities in successive lives, but on the other hand, it changes a good deal, as we have always described, as we pass through human evolution from life to life. People do not perceive their true being because they fail to discern the whole mobility of their body and the very real living activity of their I. This is like a golden rule in relation to real knowledge of or insights into the human being. Why is this so? The answer is provided by our knowledge of Ahriman and Lucifer. We split our being into two, on the one hand seeing our body as something that was once small and then grew larger, whereas in fact it continually renews itself. What do we actually perceive when we regard our body in this way? We perceive the Ahrimanic, as this Ahrimanic activity works upon us. Yet This Ahrimanic quality is not our true human nature, but is rather the type or species that does remain the same through all ages. In looking upon our body as we do, therefore, we are perceiving the Ahrimanic aspect of our nature. And in fact, modern mainstream anthropology only describes this Ahrimanic aspect. That is one half of what we see, our physical nature as we ourselves conceive and concentrate it. The other half is the abstract I, in a really very fluctuating state, living only a temporal existence as we envisage ourselves in life between birth and death. This encompasses our whole own education and upbringing, our morality or waywardness, our whole personal life. Yet we do not perceive the reality of our I as this works to transform our physical life. Instead, we see it diluted, luciferically attenuated. Our physical corporeality is something we perceive as Ahrimanically materialized, whereas we perceive our soul and spirit as luciferically attenuated. If this were not so, and we did not split ourselves in half, to leave one pole of our being Ahrimanic and the other luciferic, we would have a much closer relationship with the dead, who are continually amidst us, since we would also have a much closer connection with the world of spirit. We would comprehend the whole reality, including the realm in which we live after passing through death, and before we enter this world again, through the portal of conception. In fact, we never really have a full perception of our being, but on the one hand, the illusory Ahrimanic picture of our physical corporeality, and on the other, the illusory luciferic picture of our soul and spirit. Two illusions about ourselves, between which, albeit imperceptibly, lives our true human reality. Yet it is of this human nature we must speak if we speak of the human being at all. Since it is our true and intrinsic being that passes from one life to the next. This insight into human nature is deeply significant and shows us why people think that human beings remain the same through many succeeding ages. We must focus clearly on misguided ideas of the human being, the species or genus aspect that does remain constant through long ages, and on the other hand, the false apprehension of soul and spirit that fails to see its living dynamic in our life. If people recognized how the spirit and soul change the body year by year, they would also grasp the huge transition that occurs when this spirit-soul enters physical corporeality at conception, or departs from it again at death. We take no account, mostly, of how the spirit-soul works upon the body. There is another way, too, to express what has just been said. Our Ahrimanic view of the more or less fixed and finished human organism accounts for very little, really, of what we are. We merely live in this organism. The aspect of it we usually perceive as something Ahrimanically condensed and concentrated originates much more from our last incarnation than from this one. From our various reflections this year, and from previous ones too, you will realize that your physiognomy and other enduring aspects of your form really derive from your past incarnation, your last life. Everything associated with the physical body is much more connected with your last life than with this one. But people today who do not believe they have had a previous life cannot accept that such a life could have provided their current shape and form, their size, and so forth. True understanding would require us to look back to our last life, and we would be helped in this if we could start to see the I, capital, as it works upon our organism, as I have described. We would become aware of all that we ourselves cannot shape and form in the present, but what was formed in former lives. If one can really study the human being with insight, one knows how the soul and spirit work upon our organism. The human being emerges in a sense from this work, leaving behind, as apparently fixed form in Aramanic perception, what remains from a former life, as all that has previously been shaped. If we can accustom ourselves to seeing the human being's nature as very dynamic and alive, when we meet another person, it is always as if someone emerges from him as the present human being. Usually this is not perceived. The part that remains somewhat behind is the aspect of the person that was shaped in a former life. And very soon something steps into what emerges in this way. The emerging aspect is initially very transparent, one can say, and then grows more opaque. Because the spirit soul manifests in activity, it condenses what has emerged, and then something emerges in turn from this, which appears as a seed or germ for the next life on earth. A person appears as a threefold being to someone who can comprehend the reality. Various mythological traditions have encapsulated this in symbolic form. You will no doubt recall numerous tales involving three generations, and this is because they refer to this emergence of the three aspects I have described. If you think of various portrayals of Isis and some tales in Christian traditions, you will find an account of three successive figures who belong together. In reality, this indicates what I have referred to. Of course, such things can be interpreted materialistically if you have a mind to do so. Grandmother, mother, and child, perhaps. But the three figures exist because they correspond to a perceived reality. Images from earlier times are best understood if you refrain from the academic fantasies of today, which analyze such things arbitrarily. It is much more productive to recall what people actually perceived not so very long ago, and then portrayed what they saw in artistic form. Reflections such as these become especially important if we realize that the Christ who passed through the mystery of Golgotha has a connection, one we frequently speak of, with the authentic human eye, capital. If you think of the Pauline phrase, "Not I, but Christ in me," this "in me" refers to the true I, which for us today is hidden and concealed. To find the right relationship with Christ, we must in a sense look upon this I in its spiritual reality. It is hard to see how certain words and phrases in the Gospels can be comprehended if no account is taken of this. Consider the phrase in the Gospel of St. John, where the evangelist speaks of the Christ coming to humankind as to the place where he rightfully belongs. Translators of the Gospels usually render this as, quote, "He came unto his own, and his own received him not," close quote. But the passage then continues, quote, "But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become the children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God." Close quote. And it becomes apparent, therefore, that he wished to come to all those who have such awareness. Yet outward people, or in other words, all those usually in existence, are certainly, quote, "born of blood and of the will of the flesh." Close quote. But the human being I have spoken of as the true and authentic one, who is not born of blood or the will of the flesh, comes from the world of spirit, and only clothes himself in what comes from physical inheritance. The Gospel speaks of this authentic human being, and this is why it is so hard to comprehend and is so often wrongly interpreted, because it is pressed into the kinds of concepts that are current today. Without the ideas spiritual science can convey, such gospel passages cannot be understood. Once we have these concepts, a light suddenly dawns on us in relation to the Gospels. In regard to all these circumstances, we have to say that something of grandeur occurred in human evolution at the mystery of Golgotha. As you know from my books and lectures, this whole human I lived differently before this point from how it lived after it. The moment when the mystery of Golgotha took place was at the same time one when the whole of human consciousness changed. Naturally, this was because the Christ being united with earthly evolution, as I have often described. Increasingly, we should understand the nature of the mystery of Golgotha and its relationship to humankind. Many exponents of the Gospels stumble over passages where, in one way or another, it is said that, quote, heaven descended to earth, close quote. Among those who completely misunderstood this was Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, who believed Christians were claiming that a kind of heavenly kingdom had descended to the earth, but that otherwise nothing had altered, that ears of corn, say, or cherries, did not suddenly become 12 times bigger, and so forth. Her point is that things on earth remained unchanged, and this, quote, descent of the heavenly kingdom, close quote, becomes very problematic for many exegesists because they fail to understand it. The real meaning is this. Until that point, people experienced the spiritual realm within and through physical earthly conditions by means of an atavistic clairvoyance. Subsequently, they had to raise themselves to the spirit, perceiving things in a realm of spirit that did indeed arrive. One has no need for the ingenious twists and turns proposed by many to explain this phrase, but one can simply accept the reality as it is described there. When Christ passed through the mystery of Golgotha, human beings could no longer receive their spiritual existence by virtue of their merely physical existence, but must now live in the spiritual world. Someone who lives only in the physical world no longer lives upon the earth, but beneath it, since from the mystery of Golgotha onward it has become possible to live in the spirit. The spiritual realm has really come amongst us, and this expression can immediately be understood if we grasp it as I have suggested. Christ has a real relationship with the spirit, although initially this is to remain concealed. This ought only slowly to be imparted to human beings through their own endeavors. And only when we grasp this can we understand the real course of modern history since the mystery of Golgotha. In the early centuries, Christianity, as it arrived in the world through the mystery of Golgotha, implanted itself in the Gnosis, that was more or less still in existence. People had very spiritual ideas to comprehend the real nature of Christ Jesus. But then the church acquired a definite form, as you can trace in history. But you have to understand what the task of this ecclesiastical form was from the 3rd, 4th, and 5th century onward. Please do not misunderstand me. Spiritual science shows genuine and active tolerance toward all existing religious confessions and traditions, and has to be able to see the relative truth of their diverse traditions. Spiritual science does not favor one confession more than another. It seeks rather to bring to light the truth of different religious perspectives, carefully weighing them and refraining from one-sidedness. Spiritual science should not be seen to tend more toward a particular confession. It seeks to reveal knowledge of the spirit. For instance, spiritual science can well understand that it is a shame if many lose touch with what lies in Catholic rites and worship, and is aware of the benefits of such worship for culture. It is also fully aware that Catholic worship has been closely associated with fine works of art, and that Catholicism, far more than is realized, perpetuates various other religious confessions. There are deep mysteries at the heart of Catholic worship. But what I am speaking of here relates to something very different from the Catholic Mass, even though the latter has its own full justification and has been a huge stimulus to human creativity. Ecclesiastical forms received certain tasks, and still possess them today, in fact, when such fervent souls as Bernard of Clairvaux emerged from the Church and lived in devotion to their God. We have to distinguish carefully here. The Church, on the one hand, and figures such as Bernard of Clairvaux and numerous others. What task did the Church have? Its task is to keep souls as distant as possible from knowledge of Christ, to prevent them coming too close to Christ. Ecclesiastical history from the 3rd and 4th centuries onward largely reveals how human sensibility distances itself from real understanding of the mystery of Golgotha. In the Church's development lies a certain opposition to understanding of Christ. This negative task of the Church is also justified, in that people continually have to strive anew to find Christ through the powers of their own soul. Basically, whenever people come to Christ throughout these centuries, this involved opposition to or rebellion against ecclesiastical thinking. Figures such as Bernard of Clairvaux also really rebel against the Church. Even Thomas Aquinas was regarded as a heretic in Church circles. He was frowned upon, and his teachings were only adopted at a later stage. The path to Christ has really always involved pushing back against the Church, and people could only find their way toward Christ by effort in a slow, gradual way. It is worth remembering that, for instance, the Waldensian sects, founded in the 12th century by Petrus Waldus, as yet had no knowledge of the Gospels, for ecclesiastical life had spread without them. A strange but curious fact. In the community that gathered around Petrus Waldus, people were sought out who could translate passages from the Gospels. In this way, some knowledge of them arose, and thus a stream of heightened Christian life began to flow from them. In consequence, the Pope declared Petrus Waldus to be a heretic. Right up to these times, in Europe too, certain Gnostic insights were prevalent, for instance, among the Cathars, whose name can be translated as the Pure Ones. But this Gnostic wisdom sought to engender ideas, tangible ideas, about Christ and the mystery of Golgotha. The official Church did not want this, and thus the Cathars were also declared heretics. It is very important to bring the clear light of awareness to bear on these things, and distinguish the path of Christianity from that of the Church as institution. By drawing on spiritual scientific foundations, people today can forge a path to the true Christ, to the true idea of Christ. A great deal of modern history, too, becomes clear if we know that not everything invoking the name of Christ sought to convey understanding of the mystery of Golgotha, but on the contrary, often aimed to hinder it. These barriers to understanding are still in place in our own time, very much so. And here I would like to describe some things that are characteristic of this. Efforts, including Protestantism, that arose in many places to oppose the Church, were due to this role of the Church in erecting barriers to an understanding of Christ, thus necessitating individual endeavor to attain such understanding. Petrus Waldus did this by seeking out the Gospels. Until then, people only had the Church, not the Gospels. Even today, there are many who have strange views about the relationship between the Church and the Gospels. I would like to read you an excerpt from a modern book that is very characteristic of this. Here you can see that views which cast Petrus Waldus as a heretic because he sought the path to Christ through the Gospels, still take root in our own time. Here is a passage from the book, quote, The Gospels and the Epistles are of incomparable value to us as written documents testifying to revelation. Yet they are neither the foundation upon which our faith first had to develop, nor the sole source from which we may actively draw the contents of our faith. In our view, the Church is older than the Holy Scripts. We receive them from its hand, and it offers the pledge of their credibility. In the face of the risks of handwritten accounts and the alteration of wording in the course of translation into all the languages of the earth, the Church must remain the only reliable interpreter of the meaning and scope of gospel passages. Close quote. Thus, rather than the words of the Gospels themselves, what the Church tells us should be sought in the Gospels is the decisive thing. I have to point this out since much naivete exists even in our circles in relation to this. Even in our circles, you can often hear the view expressed that we would make more headway with the Catholic Church if we were seen to have a Christ-friendly stance. But this will not help us in the least with the Catholic Church. On the contrary, it puts us at loggerheads with it, since nothing about Christ, and nothing that exceeds the scope of mere science, can be disseminated in the Catholic Church unless the Church itself first acknowledges this as an authorized doctrine. Anyone amongst us, therefore, who propounds ideas about Christ and thinks that this can be accepted by the Church will be seen as heretical, because the Church does not accord anyone the right to speak of Christ in any other than the strictly authorized way. The author who wrote the above passage makes this very clear. Quote, "A person of faith will, of course, hold views corresponding to those the scientist holds of the facts of his experience." Close quote. In other words, he is saying that the faithful must acknowledge Church tenets about the world of spirit in the same way that the eyes of a scientist give him information about the world. Then he continues, quote, "He must accept them as they are, not subtracting from or adding anything to them. And this acceptance and acknowledgement of the real state of affairs, as far as possible, cleansed of all subjective tinge, is what is asked of him. The truths of revelation are likewise a given for those who grasp them in faith. They are also something concluded and complete. After the time of Christ, they cannot be further enhanced, nor can they be diminished. All change or modification of their content is excluded." Close quote. This is written by someone fully rooted in what Orthodox Catholicism has to propound. This orthodoxy will inevitably turn aside with some disdain from efforts initiated by figures such as Lessing to seek the soul and spirit once again. Lessing got as far as envisaging reincarnation, starting from a modern life of spirit. Everything founded on the Catholic Church, by contrast, is in inevitable and stark opposition to German culture and spiritual life as this flowed through Lessing, Herder, Goethe, and Schiller. For this reason, the author whose work I quoted above also writes, quote, "The edifice of ecclesiastical doctrine, as nowadays acknowledged and presented by theologians, was however not complete and concluded from the outset. What Christ told the apostles, and these in turn proclaimed to the world, was not a methodically progressing and universal system, but a wealth of truths that are all united, as in a single point, in the one fact of the story of our Lord, of God become man. But instruction of the faithful and defense against attacks by heathens and misinterpretations by heretics made it necessary to connect these truths together systematically, to develop their full content and determine their precise meaning. This occurred in the form of doctrinal enactments by the organs appointed to do this. It was done in the Catholic view under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, but at the same time with the collaboration of ecclesiastical studies initiated at an early stage in the Church's history. The revelation did not create a new language, but drew on that already current revising the meaning, and enhancing the significance of individual words and phrases. Theology, too, which undertook to expound the contents of this revelation in an ordered and doctrinal way, and to penetrate it speculatively, required for this certain tools and aids, clearly defined terms to structure the material, special expressions to indicate comprehensibly relationships and connections that exceed the scope of daily experience. In this, Greek philosophy found its new world historic task, that of helping prepare the vessels into which was now poured an infinitely richer content from higher sources. Originally, the source was Platonism, whose speculation focused upon the supersensible, directly prompted this. Much later, after more than a millennium, when the most important constituents of revelation had long since found their doctrinal formulation, a close connection between theological disciplines and Aristotelian philosophy was forged, and continues to this day. Close quote. Thus it seems that since Aristotelian philosophy was reconciled with the Church back in medieval times, it is still valid in the Church of today. Quote, "With its aid, St. Thomas Aquinas, a systematist par excellence, erected the great edifice of Church doctrine, which in the following centuries, with only small modifications, determined the form, expression, and mode of instruction of Catholic theology." Close quote. The gentleman who wrote this book realizes that what he calls church doctrine emerged from a certain connection between the substance of Christian wisdom and the Aristotelianism of ancient Greece. He even envisages a future possibility, albeit still a long way off, for he expressly states, quote, "in a future by no means yet approaching," close quote, when people might view Christianity with quite different ideas and concepts. He asks what would have happened if Christianity had not spread via Greek philosophy, but as it might have done, through Indian philosophy. Everything would have assumed a different form. And yet he insists that we must stick with the form it has now received, and cannot modify this with other outlooks emerging in the modern world. However, he does sense that this becomes problematic at some points. Quote, "I only reject a frame of mind that in areas where full freedom is accorded to scientific research, is deaf to all objections, however well justified, and clings instead to tradition." Close quote. Nevertheless, he does cling pretty securely to tradition. Quote, "And finally, we do have to concede some things in the same way that concessions were made to the Copernican system." Close quote. But the Church only conceded this in 1827. But he rejects justified attempts to comprehend Christianity anew from the perspective of modern consciousness. He finds this most unappealing and states, quote, "I can conceive that in a future, by no means yet approaching, the connection between Aristotelian philosophy and theology will loosen, with concepts that are then no longer comprehensible and still less satisfying being replaced by others corresponding to a greatly enhanced state of knowledge." Close quote. He finds it, in quotes, "conceivable that something no one anyway any longer understands might be replaced by something else that likewise no one understands." Quote, "This would not run counter to the gospel's warning, for rather than pouring new wine into old wineskins, the reverse would be true. New vessels would be created in which to preserve the inexhaustible and intrinsically unaltered nature of the wine of the salvation doctrine, and offer it to the faithful." Close quote. But this ought not to happen, since, as he goes on, quote, "these vessels must be suitable in nature. The attempts made in the 17th century with Cartesian ideas, and in the 19th century with the philosophy of Kant and Hegel, admonish us to be cautious. A system of concepts that would replace the Aristotelian must, like the latter, emerge from a wealth of knowledge and contemporary awareness. This conceptual framework would have to succeed in achieving widespread acceptance amongst thinking humanity. Even then, its application to ecclesiastical theology would be hard to accomplish without all kinds of errors and confusion. Close quote. Work would be needed to engender the right understanding. Quote, after all, the same was true in the 13th century when, mediated by the Arabs, the whole of Aristotelian philosophy came to the awareness of the Christian Occident. There was a violent refusal to acknowledge it in many quarters. Even Thomas Aquinas was not spared hostility in this regard. Many at the time regarded him as an innovator against whom the defenders of the old, tried and tested school of thought must direct their attacks. Close quote. Human nature is remarkable in absolutely refusing, on principle, to allow something to surface that can very easily be conceived, where this involves suppression of an old understanding of Christianity, by a newer one. Nor can we say that this account is naive. It is actually very scholarly, for the booklet concludes with a really very significant pointer to a religious order that has always set great store by cleverness and intellect, and took a quite different stance from that of Bernard of Clairvaux or Francis of Assisi, who expressed more mystical and pious inclinations. The other religious order I am thinking of placed less emphasis on such things as mystical piety, instead accentuating a certain cleverness and intellectual comprehension of life. For this reason, the booklet concludes as follows, quote, I will end with a saying by St. Ignatius Loyola, adopted by the constitutions of the Jesuit order, and in recent times once again accorded significance in many quarters. Quote, a preoccupation and concern with science, if pursued with the pure striving of an act of worship, is, since it encompasses the whole human being, not less but more pleasing to God than practices of penance and expiation. Close subquote, close quote, Steiner again. In our times, people have tried to awaken clear understanding in many diverse ways. Let me demonstrate this to you with an example. Today, I have read some passages to you from a book which can show how some adopt a particular stance within the orthodoxy I described. A gentleman who has written an essay on the author of the booklet I quoted from can illustrate this further. It is important to note that this essay was written quite recently. Let me read you something from it. Quote, in his talk given in 1893 entitled The Role of Science in Catholicism and the Position of Catholic Scholars in the Present Day, the author states, subquote, we Catholic scholars of the 19th century are convinced that there is no conflict between knowledge and faith, but that the nature of both can coexist in mutual harmony. We are certain that truth is not and cannot be twofold. God is the source of all truth, and has spoken to us through the prophets and the Logos become man. He speaks to us in the doctrines of the Church, but no less so in the laws of logic to which we must adhere, where we strive for knowledge of natural truths. And since God cannot contradict himself, so there can be no conflict between natural and supernatural laws, nor between the teachings of revelation and serious, honest laws of logic, and a science which subscribes to methodological rules. Close subquote. In stating this, however, he leaves philosophy in a cul-de-sac. Its freedom appears to us to be no more than that of the fire enclosed in its grate, or the prisoner shut in by walls. Simply having feet to walk around the exercise yard, and hands to use for whatever activity is permitted, does not make the prisoner free. And no more is a philosophy free whose principles are subject to the limiting dominion of faith. A Catholic philosophy inevitably contains a contradiction in that it is not freely self-determining. Close quote. Steiner again. If our science of the spirit were not freely self-determining, it too would not be what it should be. The passage continues, quote, Catholic philosophy has a predetermined path, whereas a philosophy that lays claim to academic rigor must adhere with relentless consistency only to what arises from independent research and thinking, and is bound by the strict rules of inquiry and empirical proof. It must not be founded on a particular faith or any ecclesiastical dogma, for then it is no longer science, but instead unscientific dogmatism. In the latter case, it is determined not by scientific principles, but by the articles of faith. Rather than pursuing its own unhindered way, it acknowledges in advance a truth to which it subscribes rather than to the intrinsic, independent laws of inquiry. Close quote. Steiner again. And it is this, precisely, which is our contemporary task, to find the path upon which each individual soul can be founded on itself and its own experience. The Catholic text from which I quoted earlier therefore stands in crass opposition to the real tasks of our day. And as you see, there are people who realize this, that a scientific worldview is not possible if one starts from predetermined perspectives. And yet it seems to be very difficult nowadays to retain an unprejudiced point of view, despite the urgent need for this. The further advance of culture will depend on people discovering their inner connection with the world of spirit. Those who fail to see this are placing obstacles in the way of the most vital contemporary task. But seeing it is not enough. One also has to draw the right consequences from it. The curious thing today is that people can have insight, but then draw quite different consequences. The author of the essay I just quoted from continues with a hymn of praise to the man whose views he has just taken issue with, which culminate in a Jesuit confession of faith. This man was Count Georg von Hertling, and the author of the essay that takes issue with his views concludes as follows, quote, "Count Hertling is a decided individual. The word individual means indivisibility, but this is, at the same time, the basis for inner nuance and fully structured organization. Here an individual soul, the soul of a tribe and of a nation, merge and have a mutually enhancing effect. This unity of three in one is what renders him so strong and stamps him with the quality of the one chosen to be the chancellor of the German Empire." Close quote. Today we need to find ways to shape the vessel into which the fluidum of spiritual science must flow. And this can happen only if this vessel is a conduit whereby the human soul finds its way to the life of spirit. It is vital to grasp this, connected as it is with the most necessary impulses of our age. You see, our age is asking us not only to gain greater understanding, but when we do, to draw the necessary consequences and act accordingly. A science of the spirit will only be able to stand its ground in those who really have courage for the truth. Otherwise, contradictions, as in the passage above, will increasingly rear their heads. I also say this because time and again some naive minds amongst us are so delighted to discover apparent praise for some aspect of spiritual science. It is important to be very discerning here. Praise can actually be much more damaging to us than criticism, as long as the latter is honestly intended. Recently, by chance, I read a review of a book by Hermann Heisler, a Protestant theologian, who collected some of his sermons in a book entitled Life Questions, 17 Sermons by Hermann Heisler. The review is very characteristic in its inconsistency, although some of our naive friends may count it among the offerings in which they take much pleasure. The reviewer writes, long quote, "These sermons deserve special regard, if for no other reason, because of the preacher himself. He was a Protestant priest in Steiermark and Bohemia for 10 years. But then, alarmed by the risk of going stale in the routines of his work, left his calling and spent many years in profound study of science and philosophy. Eventually, his inner vocation reasserted itself, and he returned to it with fresh joy and love. Since he could not serve his fatherland with arms, he offered his spiritual services to the church in his native Baden, and was appointed to the diocese of Constance. It was there in 1917 that he gave the 17 sermons which compose this book. Their content is outstanding in quality, displaying thorough engagement and acuity, and requiring some effort of audience and readers. The sermons do not seek to kindle beautiful feelings, but through serious cogitation to shape conviction into knowledge. Thus they avoid any kind of sermonizing tone and almost read like well-considered yet popular academic treatises on religious problems. In particular, I would mention a sermon on the much-debated concept of freedom, which arrives at the following true conclusion, subquote, "Naturally, compulsion always governs us. Even as free individuals, we pursue goals that are most attractive to us. But the divine gift of freedom brought to us by Christ is that the lower temptations of the sensory world lose their compelling power over our soul, while the glory of the world of spirit gains inner ascendancy over us." Close subquote. Continue quote. However, the quality of these sermons is not confined to their thoroughness of thinking, but lies in the specific content of the thoughts expressed. Eisler is an enthusiastic theosophist, or as he himself would prefer to say, an adherent of spiritual science. This should not be confused, though, with a spiritualist belief in the materialization of spirits. But instead, Heisler asserts that the spirit acts freely and independently of any material means. Our thoughts, he says, are powers which, though invisible, emanate from us with great potency and impress the stamp of our being upon all of nature with either beneficial or deleterious effects. This belief in the indestructible power of the spirit offers comfort in the sermon, "Our dead still live," and assumes a surprising form in the sermon, "Destiny." Based on the text of John chapter 9, "The Man Born Blind," Heisler here revives the ancient Indian and Orphic teaching of the migration of souls, or of reincarnation of the soul in an earthly body. In doing so, the preacher seeks to resolve the problem of what so often seems to be the injustice of destiny. Like Lessing in his title, "The Education of the Human Race," he wishes to awaken belief in destiny as divine education. To sum up Heisler's views, one can say that he regards his whole spiritual science as a return to the New Testament, and that he presents it as a rigorous discipline, and thus one which overcomes the Kantian division between knowledge and faith. Close quote. Steiner continues here, "You might well say, well, what could be better than such a review? And yet the man who writes all this concludes as follows, quote, "Personally, I reject this spiritual science and remain with Kant. And yet these sermons contain so many good things, and theosophy currently informs theology so significantly, for example, in Rittelmeyer's essays, that I believe many, both theologians and laypeople, will be well served by reading them." Close quote, Steiner again. This is a very common phenomenon of our time, lack of inner strength and courage in people's thinking. The reviewer has only good things to say about the book, and one sees that he really does recognize something of value in it. And yet suddenly he states, quote, "Personally, I reject this spiritual science." Close quote. There you have the fruits of what I described before, which are connected with many aspects of our modern culture. In a week's time, we will reflect further on this, the stream I described today, which then leads into social democracy and Bolshevism. The end of Lecture 19.